have a personal relationship with our Lord will survive what lies ahead, but we don't know what's going to happen. But remember, as Thomas Jefferson said, I tremble for my every country when I reflect that God is just. Justice will not sleep forever. So we ask you to pray for America, to pray for revival, because if we don't have a great revival, I can't imagine that this country will survive as a free nation. But then please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at and that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are being expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, and, well, for the next hour, they're going to be those of William Grigg, who used to be the senior editor for the New American Magazine. Now, of course, he writes his blogs, he has his own radio station, and he's writing a new book, a wonderful source of information, but we're privileged to have him here as our featured guest every Friday evening at this time. So without further ado, William, thanks very much for being with us.
Dr. Stan, thank you so much for those kind words. It's always a blessing to be with you.
And, of course, I've been reading your blogs this week about this poor little 7-year-old girl who was murdered by the police. These guys, you know, they had a film crew. They were going to show the American people really what great cowboys they were as they attacked this home to serve a warrant for somebody who was wanted for murder. And they killed a little 7-year-old girl there that they threw. Well, I'm going to let you tell the story, but this is the sort of thing that we unfortunately have. We want to look good. Boy, we are really there. You've seen us on television with our black helmets and our black bulletproof vests and our weapons charging into a home when there's nobody there, or charging in a home, you know, to serve a warrant, or going into the wrong home. I mean, we've militarized our police, and we've given them simply immunity for murder. And here's a case of murder. So you pick up the story there, William.
You're referring, of course, to this horrible story involving 7-year-old Ianna Jones. May she rest in God's peace. She was a radiant little girl living in what appeared to be a less than optimal environment, Detroit, which is a city, of course, that is in its death throes. There's no genteel way of describing what's going on in Detroit, which, of course, at one point was sort of the showpiece of America's industrial economy. Back in the 1950s and 1960s, Detroit was the bellwether for America as the world leader in commercial and industrial production. And since the late 1960s, largely aided and abetted by the forces of collectivism, and unfortunately there's a very strong racial undercurrent here that has been cultivated by the people ruling us, Detroit has been falling apart. It has burned intermittently, it has been convulsed by riots, and now it is an economic moonscape. There are places in Detroit where unemployment is over 30% for the working age male population. So Ianna Jones was living in this duplex, and apparently somebody in her extended family knew a 34-year-old individual who was wanted on a murder warrant. It was about a week ago that a 17-year-old boy was gunned down in front of a store, and there was a 34-year-old, twice this guy's age, but still apparently part of the gang culture is what I get from reading the press accounts, who allegedly gunned this guy down, and somehow he had some distant connection to an extended member of Iana Jones' family. He apparently was in the upper separate part of this duplex. It was a multi-story dwelling. The police obtained a search warrant on the basis of investigations made on the street, street-level investigations by homicide detectives and street cops. They knew where the guy was. They got a warrant. They should, of course, have taken him in. He was somebody who was a very plausible suspect in a murder. But instead of doing what would have been done a generation ago, surrounding the house, staking out the house, waiting patiently to arrest him when no harm would have come to anybody else, they chose the high-profile, high-impact, telegenic route of a SWAT raid, and this little girl was killed by a gunshot after being burned by a flashbang grenade.
But, of course, the thing is that they had the television cameras there. Yes. They had a private, so they couldn't wait. I mean, the television cameras were there. This was a publicity stunt, and they had to do something. After all, how long are the television cameras going to wait?
Yeah.
They got to do something. And so they were committed to doing something. And, so, well, you pick up the story, and they killed this little girl. But who's responsible? Well, nobody's responsible. We were just, well, somebody's responsible because she's dead. You go right ahead, William.
You're exactly right. The film crew from the A&E program, First 48 Hours, was there. That's one of these so-called reality shows. That's an oxymoron. A television program does not depict reality. It massages it. It stylizes it. I refer to the principle in physics called the observer effect in describing what happens when people are involved in television, including this oxymoronic, very common genre called reality television. People become mannered and self-aware in the presence of a camera. And they pose, they preen, they try to present themselves to their best advantage. And this, of course, should have nothing to do with police work. You should not have cameras present for the purpose of creating what amounts to a mini-series or a limited-run drama starring the chief of police. And that's what this ultimately is all about. The chief of police of Detroit is an ambitious bureaucrat by the name of Warren Evans. I believe his name is Warren Evans. He was appointed about a year ago to try to rehabilitate a scandal-plagued and thoroughly corrupt police department that is under two separate memoranda from the Justice Department. It's a bad thing. I don't like the federal government, the so-called Justice Department, taking over police departments. Often they end up in a situation where a court order called a consent decree is handed down, in which the federal government becomes the supervisory custodian of a police department. Detroit is under a couple of those because of legitimate problems. So Mr. Evans has appointed the police chief, and he has been auditioning to become a reality television star. As I point out in the current essay of Pro Libertate, there's a film excerpt, about a six-minute-long film excerpt called a sizzle reel that is being shopped around in Hollywood and in New York City, starring Chief Evans. And in it, he assumes all of the de rigueur macho poses and talks about how he's going to take back his city. He's posing with an assault weapon. This guy is a bureaucrat, but he's out there kitted out as if he's actually going to be leading these full-force raids himself. So we have the situation where a murder suspect has been tracked down in this duplex. It's a multifamily dwelling. There are toys strewn on the front yard. This is obviously a place where children live. Now, a generation ago, the standard operating procedure would have been for the police to stake out that building and wait until the suspect came out, then arrest him outside so that nobody would get hurt.
Or how about go in and try to get the children out so that they wouldn't be hurt if there
was
a...
That's the other thing they would have done. They would have gotten the children out, or they would have waited until the suspect came out of the home. But a generation ago, or perhaps even as recently as a couple of years ago, they wouldn't have gone in a paramilitary raid, throwing a flashbang grenade through a window, and then apparently, according to...
Hold that thought. Well, this is Dr. Stanton. You go right ahead, William, because William's describing what happened is they had a flashbang grenade. Now, these are grenades that go off, and they burn people.
Yes.
And they burn them alive. But they threw this. They don't know where the flashbang grenade is going to land. They just throw it through a window, and they don't know who's on the other side of the window. And there's a little 7-year-old girl there sleeping. Go ahead.
Yeah, the 7-year-old girl, Anna Jones, was sleeping on the couch. She had been tucked in a couple of hours before by her father. She was sleeping next to her grandmother, a 47-year-old woman. And the flashbang grenade went through the window and landed on her and apparently severely burned her. And within a couple of seconds, she was dead from a single gunshot. Apparently, there was only one shot fired during the course of this raid. It was a shot that hit and killed the 7-year-old girl.
But how could they miss a little 7-year-old girl, or were they just firing in blindly to, as part of this whole aspect of creating fear?
That's, of course, a very important part of these full-force raids, is they want to get people off balance. They want to intimidate them. One of the things that generally happens is if there are dogs present, the dogs are shot, and then after the fact, there is a justification of aggressive behavior on the part of the dogs. The highest and most important consideration in all these operations is not the safety of the people on the receiving end of the raid, including innocent bystanders. It's officer safety. It's like force protection in a military environment. You're always thinking in terms of protecting your force in a military circumstance. That's, of course, a mindset completely incompatible with the role that's supposed to be played by peace officers in a reasonably free society. But the dispute here over the gunshot is important because the original story was that Officer Joseph Weekly, he's the guy who drives the APC, and he was the first through the door, armed with a machine gun and a ballistic shield. He says that when he went through the door, he had a scuffle with the 47-year-old grandmother of Ayanna Jones, that in the course of that scuffle, his gun accidentally discharged, and that the single gunshot fired as a result is what killed Ayanna Jones. The eyewitnesses inside the building say that the gunshot happened immediately after the flashbang grenade was thrown through the window. That, of course, wouldn't give any time for a scuffle. Now, the grandmother was held overnight by the police, then released the next morning with a very important modification to the story that was told. Instead of being party to a scuffle with Officer Weekly, the grandmother apparently had some kind of incidental contact with Officer Weekly, which wouldn't explain why the gun would go off, because the original story was that she was grabbing for his gun and that somehow, either as a result of her actions or the result of his or their actions combined, the gun was accidentally discharged. If incidental contact took place, it's almost certain that this wasn't what happened. But according to the attorney for the family, he's somebody for whom I don't have a whole lot of respect, Jeffrey Feiger. He's somebody who's been very prominently associated with the so-called Dr. Kevorkian. He claims that he has seen footage of this raid, not from the A&E film crew, but from a separate source, in which it's pretty clear that the gunshot was fired into the building before the police went in. In other words, they fired blindly into this house, and as a result, Ayanna Jones was hit and killed. Now, either way you look at it, the best case that could be made here boils down to murder, either murder through depraved indifference, which is a very important and very frequently used way of framing a second-degree murder charge, or murder through compound depraved indifference. If you're firing into a home, then there's an element of premeditation here. They didn't necessarily need to kill this particular person. But if you're shooting blindly into a residence, what do you think is going to happen? Particularly given the fact that, once again, there were toys strewn on the front yard, which is something that any police officer should notice, and the implications of which should be clear to anybody of even minimal intelligence.
Well, no, was this a raid carried out in the daytime or nighttime?
It was carried out at 12:40 in the morning.
All right, so it was bright daylight. There's no, okay.
Yeah, but they had been told before going in, they'd been told by people on the streets that there were people living in that house that had children. They knew going in that there were children in the house. There was the 7-year-old, and there were apparently either in the downstairs or in the upstairs unit, I don't know which, there were other children of that age or perhaps even younger than Ayanna. But they had no excuse not to know that there were children present. But, of course, all of this is bound up with the dynamics and necessities of staging a telegenic, high-profile paramilitary raid with a film crew present. And this is part of the PR strategy which has been adopted by Chief Evans here, who is posing now, positioning himself to become a reality TV star. And rather than thinking in terms of what would be the best and least hazardous to the public route of apprehending this murder suspect, they chose a method that was dictated by, quite frankly, the aesthetics of television.
Well, you know, this is so reminiscent of Waco, when, of course, they had the television cameras there. I mean, they could have certainly knocked on the front door and gained access, but they didn't want that. They wanted an incident. And, of course, they, first of all, they shot the dogs. When David Koresh came to the front door, opened it, said, "Hey, fellas, you know, there are women and children in here," they shot him in the abdomen. They closed the door, and just about that time, a helicopter came over and began shooting blindly down into Waco. But it was all there. The cameras were there. The video cameras were there. It was a publicity stunt. And nobody, in fact, I talked to the woman who heard the trial, Sarah Bain. She told me the wrong people were tried. The police, the BATF had killed those people, and they should have been on trial, but the government wouldn't do that. They sent the people who were defending themselves and the women and children there to prison for 40 years. And basically, when the attorney who had actually been victorious, the federal attorney, felt so badly about what he had done, he tried to remedy the situation, and the government came after him and threatened to send him to prison for allowing, of course, the investigators to find out the government had lied about their use of explosives and lied about so much of what happened. And instead of going after the people who lied, they went after the attorney who tried to remedy the crime he had committed against humanity.
That's exactly right. You know, they were acquitted. The Davidian defendants were acquitted in state court before they were put on trial on federal charges of basically conspiring to murder the people who were attacking their home. They've been acquitted in the state court under the law in Texas, which specifically and explicitly recognizes the right to resist unlawful arrest. There are a number of states that have provisions of that sort in their laws, and there are a couple of constitutions, state constitutions, that actually mention in substance that same principle. But there was a factual finding in the state trial, the homicide trials of the Davidians, that they came under unlawful and unwarranted attack, that they were defending themselves, that they had no duty to retreat, and that their only alternative was essentially to be annihilated in what was essentially a criminal raid staged, as you point out, for reasons of propaganda and PR. Sharon Wheeler, the ATF commissarina in charge of agitprop, had actually contacted the local press and announced that this operation, which was codenamed Showtime, significantly, was going to be undertaken. And so it was all being staged for the benefit of the cameras in order to sanitize the image of the ATF when they were in one of their very frequent scandals. The ATF is an extremely corrupt and completely useless organization. It has no constitutional warrant. But they were under fire because of a culture of what is called institutional sexism, the mistreatment of female employees and officials in the ATF. And so they decided to take down a individual who was considered to be even more loathsome than anything the ATF would do. He was somebody who was perceived as sort of a chauvinistic, white, patriarchal, male, to use the left-wing argot, heteropatriarchal oppressor type, David Koresh. So why not take down this so-called cult leader and his fanatical followers as a way of knocking all the scandals off the headlines? And as a result, you had four ATF raiders killed, as a result of justifiable self-defense, lethal self-defense by the Davidians, and four Davidians who were killed in the criminal assault by the ATF. And 51 days later, you had scores of Americans and a handful of foreign nationals who had been living peacefully in the plains outside of Waco who were immolated. Those who weren't burned to death or suffocated were gunned down by people who were directing automatic weapons fire in the direction of the exit.
Don't forget, most of them had a bullet hole in the back of their head.
Yeah.
And I actually talked to the wife, to the mother of Clive, who was the head of that, actually, Lisa, and she told me that she was with a woman who had been told that got called on the day of the attack by somebody who said, "I will never tell you who I am, but I was watching from behind with a telescope," and they brought them out the back, and they shot them all in the back of the head and dragged them back inside the building. And we sent that information to Bob Barr. We recorded the conversation with her. You will never hear that mentioned, but we do know that they had a special forces unit there, professional trained assassins trained by our government, and they were there. It's covered in a DVD we carry called Waco, A New Revelation, and not one person in a thousand has ever seen that video. It is available from Radio Liberty. First of all, you're not supposed to send military forces against American people. They did. There was a special forces unit there, and whether the story that Clive's mother told me is true, we will never know. All we know is that they I think there were six or eight of them who had bullet holes in the back of their head. And these people did not commit suicide. They said, you know, it was against their religious beliefs. So the question, what happened to them? Well, I have heard that the Special Forces people were sent off to a place called Somalia and participated in a tragic accident called Black Hawk Down, where a number of at least 10 of the people involved there were gunned down and killed. Dead men tell no lies. Go ahead.
What you're dealing with now in terms of the SWAT raids, of which this raid last Sunday night is tragically typical, you're dealing basically with a mini Waco taking place probably 100 times a day in this country. There are between 100 and 150 on average SWAT raids being carried out in this country. It's not that they're taking down barricaded gunmen or serial killers, or that they're dealing with hostage situations, which was, of course, the advertised purpose of SWAT back when the late Darrell Gates created the first SWAT team in 1968. You're dealing with the service of routine criminal warrants. You're dealing with full-force raids to deal with misdemeanor-level amounts of marijuana or other controlled substances.
Well, William, on this, what happened as far as getting this man who had the warrant for? Did he resist?
He didn't.
He didn't resist, so it really was unnecessary.
Yes, entirely, consummately.
Well, we'll be back in just a moment with William Greek. Ladies and gentlemen, could this be maybe one of your grandchildren next time?
Yeah, Chauncey Owens, the suspect in the murder.
Gold and silver is tremendously undervalued. Global demand vastly exceeds mine supply by more than 60% annually. There is little in the financial world more certain than a coming explosion in the prices of gold and silver. The U.S. dollar continues to lose value and respect as the world's reserve currency. Our nation faces challenges on many fronts, and a day doesn't pass without another economist bringing forth warnings of impending economic calamity. There has never been a better time than right now to acquire physical gold and silver. Discount Gold and Silver Trading was founded on the principles of truth and honesty. We believe in providing a quality product, quality service, and most importantly, competitive pricing. We provide all forms of precious metals, including American gold, silver, platinum, and rare investment and circulated coins. Silver bars, rounds, and 90% silver bags are on hand for the silver investor. Gold self-directed IRAs are available. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. Toll free, that's 1-800-375-4188.
Most Americans are iodine deficient today because they stopped adding iodine to our milk and to our flour, and only about half of the salt that's consumed in the United States today contains iodine. So Radio Liberty has produced a 4-tape or a 4-CD set that discusses the health benefits of iodine. We also offer iodorol. It contains 12.5 milligrams of iodine per tablet. And we also offer potassium iodide tablets, a little protection of thyroid gland in case there's a nuclear attack. So if you'd like to order these products or obtain additional information, why don't you call 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Or go to our website at radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. Once again, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927.
Did you know that there's an increasing amount of scientific data which says that fluoride in drinking water is dangerous? Are you aware that your drinking water may in fact contain many unhealthy substances, even things which can cause sickness or disease? If you'd like information on how to remove these contaminants, find out about the Verkey water filter. You can call 800-544-8927 for complete information. There is a way to return to having pure, safe drinking water. The Verkey water filter. Call 800-544-8927 for information about a product that could protect you and your family from waterborne disease. The number to call is 800-544-8927. Call today.
This is Pastor David Whitney with Institute on the Constitution. Our founders constructed this constitutional republic with the intent that citizens would function as the final check on the power of civil government. But that design would only work if the citizens understood our form of government as well as their responsibilities within that structure. That's why Institute on the Constitution has put together a host kit that enables anyone, anywhere, with any group of people to instruct them on our founding documents. We urge you to order a host kit. You can call us toll-free at 866-730-9796. That's 866-730-9796. Or you can order it on the web. Go to our website, iotconline.com. The only way our republic will survive is if its citizens arm themselves with the knowledge of our founding fathers' original intent of the Constitution, the Declaration, and the Bill of Rights. Call us, 866-730-9796.
If you know something specifically about this, we'll accept a call. Ordinarily, we don't take calls when we have William on, but somebody out there may have more personal experience with what really happened. Our number is 1-888-24-LIVID, but you go right ahead, William.
One of the things I find interesting here about the planning and the pre-raid intelligence briefing that was given is that the SWAT team, according to a police source that talked with the Detroit Free Press about this in detail, the SWAT team reviewed a number of considerations. They were told that this individual, the one who was signed on the murder warrant, was likely armed with an assault weapon and with a handgun. They were told that the house might be a drug den, which it wasn't. It was a residence. It was a multifamily residence, multi-unit. There were more than one family living there. They were told all kinds of things about potential dangers to the SWAT operators who were going to go in and conduct this raid. But there was no discussion of the potential risks to the people living in that building. There was no discussion of the obvious fact that they were dealing with a residential dwelling where children lived. There was no discussion of the possibility that by taking this posture, by conducting a post-midnight raid, they would be putting people needlessly at risk. There was no talk of possible crossfire. They were talking in terms of officer safety. That was the first and only consideration here as they went through all the potential risk factors. This is very, very typical now. There was a time, and not all that terribly long ago, when it was understood that if you became a police officer, you were assuming certain risks, and in the event that you were put in a position in which you could choose your safety or the safety of a member of the public, then your responsibility was to protect that member of the public. And there are still police officers who behave that way. I know several. I communicate with them frequently by telephone, by email. There are still people who have that mentality of serving and protecting members of the public, even at some expense to their own safety. But in this paramilitary mindset that is so commonplace in special operations teams like the Detroit Special Response Team or SWAT teams elsewhere, it's always a matter of force protection. And that, of course, is perfectly attuned to the ethos of the military, but it has nothing to do with the role of a peace officer, which is, of course, to protect the rights of everybody, including criminal suspects. When you use force in a manner proportionate to and dictated by the necessity of the protection of the public. And that's not what happened here. And obviously, when you have a film crew along, you're dealing with something other than the protect and serve ethic. And this, once again, is very, very typical and very common. And as I mentioned before, this raid differs only in detail from raids that are going on every single day. On the average, there are 150 SWAT raids going on in this country somewhere every single day. There are at least a couple that are carried out in Detroit every day, and almost all of them involve some kind of connection to the war on drugs. And the war on drugs is very literally a war on the American public and on the Bill of Rights. Even if you don't subscribe to the idea that and this is my position, that the government has no proper role in defining the contents of our bloodstreams, in spite of the fact that I don't smoke, I don't drink, I have no interest in narcotics, I've got no interest in alcohol, I don't think that the government has the constitutional authority. As a matter of fact, you read the Constitution, pretty clear that it doesn't have that authority to regulate what it is that people consume. Back when prohibition was inflicted on this country, and we're talking about a form of prohibition, it was understood that you had to change the Constitution in order to authorize the federal government to get involved in prohibiting the sale and consumption of alcohol. The war on drugs is being carried out without any similar constitutional warrant, and it's been going on now for 40 years. Trillions of dollars have been spent. Thousands have been killed in this country, probably tens of thousands elsewhere. Millions have been sent to prison. I mean, tonight there are literally millions of people in prison because of the war on drugs here in this country, and most of them are non-white. There's a civil rights issue that the left doesn't want to touch. But all of this is going on, and we have the same rates of use and the same rates of addiction that we had 40 years ago, or even longer. You go back to when everything was legal to be consumed in this country in the 1890s, you had the same rate of addiction that you have today. All that's happening is the consolidation of power and the militarization of the police and an assault on what remains of our liberties under the Bill of Rights.
Well, we'll be back here in just a moment with William Griggs. Certainly the whether or not the drug should be legalized should be a state issue,
yes,
not a federal issue. There's no authorization in the federal government for this. They've just simply usurped the power. But, of course, what people really forget is the largest purveyor of drugs in the world is the American CIA. And if you doubt it, go up and look on the Internet. Well, William, you go right ahead.
One thing I want to say by way of what I consider to be a necessary tangent here, perhaps not even a tangent, but a necessary, an ancillary discussion to what we're discussing right now. This last week, if you want a really good example of the fact that the major media are effectively controlled by the ruling oligarchy, take a look what happened to Ron Paul. Or not Ron Paul, Rand Paul, the son of Ron Paul. Rand Paul, of course, won a thumping victory on Tuesday night in the Kentucky Senate primary. He's going to be the Republican candidate for the Senate. Within hours, he was being uniformly demonized, vilified, execrated, mocked, ridiculed, and held up for obloquy and scorn because he believes that the 1964 Civil Rights Act improperly brought private business decisions and private relationships under the ambit of federal authority. He, of course, has been categorical in saying that he believes that the Jim Crow laws had to be repealed. There should have been some kind of intervention to deal with Jim Crow. I don't happen to think that he's right that there should have been federal intervention to that end. But Jim Crow, of course, was institutional government-imposed racial discrimination. It had to be brought to an end. He said that, obviously, the government, whether you're talking about state or federal, should not be permitted to institutionalize racist policies. But when it comes to matters of business, deciding with whom to conduct business, those are private affairs. If somebody doesn't want to serve me, as I'm speaking now as William Grigg, not hypothetically, if somebody doesn't want to serve me as a customer because he doesn't like the fact that I'm not white, then that neither picks my pocket nor breaks my leg. I'll go do business elsewhere, and that person will be punished economically because of that decision. That's Rand Paul's point of view. But because he doesn't subscribe to the totalitarian implications of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, suddenly he's being looked upon and depicted now as literally a lethal threat to non-white Americans. This during a week when we had a 7-year-old black girl murdered in her home in Detroit as part of this insane, unconstitutional, ungodly war on drugs in this country that has put millions of black men, young black men in prison, blighted their lives, ruined their prospects for employability. There are people being killed tonight in Afghanistan and Iraq and Pakistan and Latin America, most of them non-white, by the same government that is waging war, the so-called war on drugs here within our shores. This, of course, is the type of so-called civil rights issue the left isn't going to touch because, of course, that would implicate the whole question of whether government should be all-powerful. They want the government to be all-powerful. Their agenda involves coercion. It involves implicating the government in all of our...
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here and go right ahead.
Yeah. It involves getting the government involved in all of our decisions. The left subscribes to Mussolini's totalitarian formula of everything within the state, nothing outside the state, nothing against the state. That's one of the reasons you'll never hear a principled critique of the so-called war on drugs from the likes of, well, Morris Deese and the Southern Poverty Law Center. You want to talk about a civil rights issue, take a look at what happens from the civil rights point of view, from the individual rights point of view, to people in the inner cities of this country because of the war on drugs. But once again, Morris Deese is a really interesting case. He's something of a drug war profiteer because he's making a very handsome living by indoctrinating state and local police against constitutionalists, against minimal government libertarian types. And most of what he's being paid is basically laundered federal money. He's not going to be coming out against one of the major federal law enforcement and police state initiatives, the war on drugs, because he knows who butters his bread. And so he'll talk about, for instance, the dangers of having so-called racists or white supremacists or people who are distantly or allegedly sympathetic to that point of view, having them in police departments or sheriff's departments. They'll always try to find something wrong with the private or individual motives of people. But when it comes to critiquing what the government actually does, you're not going to hear him take that position. And so you have these horrible things that are going on every single day, you know, scores or more, you know, hundreds of these raids being carried out. And the institutional left doesn't say anything about it. And, of course, much of the institutional right doesn't either. There's too much reflexive worship of the forces of law and order by many conservatives, at least of the statist variety, the statist perspective. And so they tend to be reflexively hostile to those who are on the receiving end of the type of violence that was inflicted on the family of Ayanna Jones last week. And so you end up with a situation where the right-wing collectivists reflexively side with the forces of law and order, and the left-wing collectivists are willing to make their peace with the forces of law and order in the interest of preserving the power of the state. And the people on the receiving end of these policies tend to be the sort of people for whom the so-called civil rights revolution was supposedly of such great benefit. And in the meantime, of course, you have the sideshow being conducted this week, the Orwellian 2 Minutes Hate, starring Rand Paul, in which pretty much every single organ of official attitude construction, whether you're talking about cable television or network television or most of the major newspapers, most of the major establishment-oriented news sites on the Internet, all of them singing basically in monotone about Rand Paul being dangerous because he doesn't believe in the sanctity of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, which ultimately wasn't about civil rights at all. It was about empowering the federal government as the totalitarian monitor of all private transactions everywhere in this country. And as a result now, you have a situation where he's probably going to become a hiss in the byword because of things that he believes, while the government that he wants to limit is busily killing people of color. And for the left, this is perfectly all right. It's an insane world we live in, and it's not getting much better anytime soon. And one of the things that some of my friends on the right need to understand about what's going on with our police right now and what happened in Detroit is unfortunately very typical of what's happening here. Back in 1962, 1963, the Kennedy administration announced, actually it was earlier than that, 1961, they announced the State Department's program for general and complete disarmament, State Department Document 7277, Freedom from War. You talked about this, Dr. Stenenum, so at least some of your audience is familiar with it. That remains, at least in broad outline, the policy today, and it talked about a three-step program in which the national arsenals of the United States and Soviet Russia would be built down, and you'd eventually have a situation where the national militaries would be seconded to the United Nations as part of a universal peacekeeping force, and every national government would retain what was called an internal security force that would be composed of militarized and centralized police along the lines, quite frankly, of what you saw in the Soviet Union and in Nazi Germany. In Nazi Germany, you had independent police forces until about 1933, 1934. By 1935 or 36, The state police forces had been turned over to the exclusive control of the central government of the Nazi Party. And they were all thoroughly militarized, and they were politicized. They were under the control of the central government. That's what you have to have if you're going to have a police state. The internal security force, I believe, described in State Department Document 7277, is basically what we're seeing now in terms of the SWAT and tactical teams that are pullulating like mushrooms after a spring rain across the countryside here. You have in every community of any significant size here, even a town like Ontario, Oregon, which is just on the other side of the Snake River from where I'm sitting tonight. I live in Payette, Idaho, which is in western Idaho, on the Snake River boundary with Oregon. Ontario, Oregon's only about 12 or 13,000 in population, but they have a SWAT team. It's not very big. It's not very well equipped. But they have a SWAT team, and it's involved in the High Desert Counter-Narcotics Task Force. And they conduct raids of the sort that we're describing, like the one that took place in Detroit last week. Not quite as dramatic. They don't take camera crews along. At least I've not noticed any evidence that they have done so. But every town has got one of these. And these weren't necessarily what were being thought of back in 1961, but in function and in the roles they're playing right now, that's pretty much the way that they're being used. They're being used for the purpose of carrying out routine police work, the service of not even necessarily felony warrants, but misdemeanor warrants. A couple of weeks ago, there was a video that absolutely tore up the Internet on YouTube from Columbia, Missouri, showing a raid that took place a couple of months ago in which an 8 or 10 member SWAT team carried out a nighttime raid against a young family, a man in his 20s, his wife, and their child. And in the course of this, within seconds, the first thing they did was they shot and killed one of the dogs and shot and wounded the others. The dog that was shot and killed was penned up. The dog that was shot and wounded was a corgi. A corgi is the size of a large cat, basically. There was a 7-year-old child present in that home in Columbia, Missouri. The police knew there was a 7-year-old child in that house, and yet they chose this method, this dramatic, dynamic entry of this house, in order to enforce a routine narcotics warrant. They were dealing with a misdemeanor amount of marijuana. We're talking, I don't know, maybe the size of a very small baggie worth of marijuana. And on the basis of going after this trivial amount of marijuana, they conducted a raid of the sort that you would expect to see being going on in Afghanistan or one that would have been taken place in Fallujah in Iraq. And they started flinging lead at the household pets, knowing that there was a 7-year-old child in the house. Now, the child was fine, apart from being terrorized, being traumatized by seeing his father thrown face first on the floor by a group of masked black-clad marauders wearing automatic weapons. The thing that's interesting, if you read the transcript or see this video, and millions have seen that video, and I think that probably tens or hundreds of thousands read the transcript, is that they shoot the dogs within seconds of going through that door. They shoot the dog. You hear the child screaming. And after shooting the dog, these masked strangers turn to the child and start saying, "No, you're okay, you're okay." Well, why should the child think he's okay? He's just seen his household pet shot. He doesn't know who these people are, why they're in his home. And the point is, in our criminal justice system as defined in the Constitution, there is no justification for this. It's done for the convenience of prosecutors, because if you're going to be enforcing laws dealing with consensual behavior, however disreputable that behavior might be, that involves disposable amounts of narcotics, you knock on the door, you announce that you have a search warrant, the evidence might disappear. Well, you know what? The evidence disappears. The world just keeps on spinning. But the thing is, in order to preserve the evidence, they're willing to put the people in that house at lethal risk, including that child. What kind of insane priorities are those? You're not dealing here with an offense against life, liberty, or property. You're dealing here with behavior that has been criminalized. You know, you're dealing with the enforcement of prohibitionist laws. But for the convenience of prosecutors, in order to make a case involving the use of this product that can be disposed of very quickly, the standard operating procedure now is to use a paramilitary team, usually trained by somebody with connections to the special forces, usually equipped by the Pentagon. That's another part of the story that's very important. And you're willing to put people at risk. And this happens every day, you know, scores of times a day, 100, 150 times a day. And that's why I say we're dealing basically with mini Wacos, you know, dozens of them every single day. And the miracle here is that you have only a handful, a relative handful, of tragic episodes like the one involving Ayanna Jones in Detroit. They could be much more plentiful. They could be much more commonplace. And unless something is done in order to hold accountable people who make those decisions and people who carry them out, really, looking at what we see right now, what's documentable right now in the press, both the decision makers in Detroit and the trigger pullers in Detroit should be brought up on criminal charges here. Unless this is done, you're going to have a situation where this is going to proliferate, it's going to exponentiate. And let me add one other consideration in the mixture that is a very uncomfortable thing to think about. More than a few people who have been involved in operations in Afghanistan and in Iraq, who have been involved in kicking in doors, going after suspected so-called insurgents or terrorist suspects, have said that the rules of engagement under which American military personnel operate overseas are more restrictive than the rules of engagement that are followed by paramilitary police here in the United States. That's a very, very disturbing thing, because if you take a look at the way that the rules of engagement are massaged and the fact that the rules of engagement overseas quite frequently are thrown out the window in the interest of force protection, if indeed those rules are more restrictive than the ones that prevail here in the United States, then God help us. And think as well of the fact that many of the people who are involved right now in these midnight raids in Afghanistan against Pashtun and Tajik families, there have been more than a few instances just in the last several months as the Obama administration has ramped up and escalated in Afghanistan, where you've had midnight raids against homes containing suspected insurgents in which you've had family members killed, men, women, and children. There was a horrible episode a couple of months ago in which an extended family had gathered in a town in Afghanistan for the purpose of celebrating the birth of a child and naming the baby. And a NATO strike force materialized late at night and then gunned down several people in the house. And then they went about sanitizing the scene by digging bullets out of the wall, digging bullets out of the bodies of the victims, who included the mother of one of those children and her sister, and then creating a cover story about this being the result of some kind of an honor killing or some kind of a Taliban attack. And it wasn't until a British journalist was able to expose what had happened that the Pentagon was willing to admit what happened. But the people conducting those raids are going to come back to the United States, and most likely they're going to find their way into what capacity? Most likely they're going to find themselves in police departments, either training or leading SWAT teams. And they're going to come to this country, and they're going to come into those roles with this background, this experience, this mindset. That mindset's going to be highly contagious. And so not only are we dealing right now with the 100 or 150 mini Wacos going on every day, we're dealing with the prospect of this becoming even nastier in the future because of the fact that these people have gone to finishing school in the 360-degree battlefield environment of Fallujah or Kabul or other places we're not being told about. And this mindset is something that has to be confronted, it has to be rebuked, it has to be banished if there's going to be any realistic prospect of restoring something akin to the constitutionally sound, locally accountable system in which peace officers will protect life, liberty, and property. But unfortunately, the trend line here that I see is leading in exactly the opposite direction. We're seeing more and more of these multi-agency preparedness training sessions of the sort that just took place a couple of days ago, or I think there's one going on right now in California, where you've got the military working with state police and local police and various federal regulatory and enforcement agencies conducting homeland security training drills that are explicitly and overtly militaristic in nature. And you have a situation now where the National Guard is taking on a more prominent role in advising and training and collaborating with the police in high-profile events such as the G20 summit that just recently took place, the two nominating conventions in 2008, the one in Denver and the one in the Twin Cities. You had National Guard taking a very active role in providing not only intelligence on the ground, but electronic intelligence, satellite intelligence, providing weapons and providing training and material support to the police on the ground. I wrote a series of articles a couple of years ago. Actually, it's been an ongoing series that I've updated and extended as developments of war. It is called Rubicon in the Rearview. Of course, rearview refers to the rearview mirror. Rubicon refers to that river that Roman soldiers were not supposed to cross, because you're not supposed to bring an army into Rome back in the late Republic in the last century before Christ. There were soldiers and generals who on a couple of occasions crossed the Rubicon.
I think it was Julius Caesar who crossed the Rubicon, and that meant that he was going to march on Rome and seize power. That was it, and overthrow the Republic.
Exactly.
And when he crossed the Rubicon, there was no turning back.
Exactly. That's the point of no return. I think Sulla might have done it before Caesar. I can't remember correctly, but Caesar, of course, is the one who famously did it. He marched his troops across the Rubicon, marched on Rome, and took Rome by force. And that is, of course, crossing the Rubicon, the cliché that refers to that point of no return after which you have committed yourself to empire rather than a republic, to dictatorship rather than the ascendancy of the primacy of the Senate and the written law. And unfortunately, right now, there are plenty of dismal indices, terrifying indices, that we have the Rubicon River in the rearview, that the law enforcement culture has permanently changed in the direction of imperial power.
And I think it's so important to remember what Julius Caesar did was overthrow the Republic.
Yeah.
We had a Republic, and they have overthrown our Republic. They've crossed the Rubicon, but the average American doesn't even understand. They think we're a democracy because everybody says it. Just shows you how effective the degree of control is over what the American people think. Our guest has certainly been William Grigg, and we'll be back in just a moment to wrap up the program and right here at Radio Liberty. Well, William, I got so intrigued in your conversation, I didn't get your chance to get your web page out, but we will. Let's just wait until...
Heart disease is on the rise. Clogged arteries, high blood pressure, and high cholesterol levels may not be fully detected by you, but the symptoms are there. Loss of energy, blood sugar spikes and drops, poor circulation, and irregular heartbeat are just a few of these that can alert you that something is wrong. Hear how Heart and Body Extract is making a difference in thousands of people's lives across America.
My blood pressure has normalized. My diabetes has totally improved.
Everyone is telling me now how much healthier I look, and I'm telling everyone how much healthier I feel. I recommend Heart and Body Extract to everyone.
Anybody over 40 in the North American continent should be using this product as a preventative to keep their cardiovascular system healthy.
Order your two-month supply today by calling 866-295-5305. That's 866-295-5305. Or order online, hbextract.com. Heart and Body Extract, 866-295-5305 or hbextract.com.
Well, I was horrified when I saw the plight of the people in Haiti after the earthquake, but a similar event could happen right here in the United States, and that's why you should call the freeze-dry guy at 866-404-FOOD, that's 866-404-FOOD, and purchase a supply of his products. Freeze-drying is a great way to preserve food. I know because I bought a supply 40 years ago, and when I opened a can recently, the food was as fresh and tasty as when I purchased it. We're living in uncertain times, so if you'd like to have a supply of ground beef, diced beef, chicken, vegetables, or fruit on hand, call the freeze-dry guy at 866-404-FOOD. That's 866-404-FOOD, and mention you heard about him right here at Radio Liberty.
Where are my car keys? What did I come in this room for? Where did I put that?
A common condition called age-related memory loss is robbing millions of people of their ability to remember and think clearly. And Alzheimer's and Parkinson's are occurring at younger ages, even early 20s and 30s. And there's much evidence that brain inflammation may be the cause. Brain inflammation may also cause depression and insomnia. But there's great news. Studies show by taking special, powerful nutrients, brain inflammation and its damaging effects may be greatly reduced. And that's why neurosurgeon Dr. Russell Blaylock created his brain repair formula to reduce brain inflammation and maintain a healthy brain. So, for a free book on brain health or information on Dr. Blaylock's special brain repair formula, call 1-800-SPECIAL or visit 1-800-SPECIAL.com. 1-800-SPECIAL.